everyone. This is Molly Douthat.
And David Douthat.
Welcome to More Than Hearing, a podcast to encourage preachers to use multiple intelligences in sermons and worship leadership, because there are plenty of ways to reach someone's soul.
Today's podcast will cover the lectionary selections for the 29th Sunday in Ordinary Time, Year B. Job gets a tongue lashing from God in a whirlwind, and James and John try to negotiate a promotion on the corporate ladder of discipleship. The divine message is consistent. You just don't get it. Hopefully, multiple intelligence theory can help us to get it better. Let's find out.
We have established this podcast based on Dr. Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences. Dr. Gardner suggests that there are multiple ways to learn, process, remember, and understand our world. Each week we develop illustrations and special effects for the weekly readings of the Revised Common Lectionary that use various smarts based on Dr. Gardner's identified intelligences. We call them word smart, eye smart, math smart, body smart, music smart, nature smart, people smart, and self smart. You can read more about Dr. Gardner's work by clicking on the link at the top of our webpage.
As we read and reflect on the scripture passages for each week, we explore ways these intelligences can be utilized for a deeper appreciation of God's Word. Anytime and any way we make use of the different smarts, we give people greater access to the Word of God so they can acquire it, process it, and internalize it in ways that make sense to them. So let's get started.
The Old Testament lesson for Year B, Ordinary 29, also Proper 26 and Pentecost plus 24, is the book of Job, chapter 38, verses 1 through 7. The lectionary committee eliminates the rest of the chapter and then has a second thought and sticks back on the end of it, verses 34 through 41. Again, as usual, do what you want to. Stick to the entire thing if you want, what the lectionary committee has recommended, or, you know, do your own thing. We're going to do our own thing.
It's worth reading.
It is. Totally.
And the couple chapters that go.
Yeah, because this response is more than seven verses.
It's three chapters, I think.
yeah, for sure. So we're going to look at verses 1 through 7 and a little bit of the part that the lectionary committee tacked back on at the end of it. It's God's response to Job's protestations of innocence and demand for a hearing. So God shows up in a whirlwind.
Yep.
Okay, so we have rather a lot of information for this, and because, just for information, because we have so much stuff for Job and for Mark, and because we kind of got started late this week, we're leaving Hebrews off. So we apologize for those of you who wanted us to find some special effects and illustrations to make sense of being a priest in the order of Melchizedek. You're on your own.
Good luck.
Let us know what you come up with. Okay, so for Job, we have an illustration in Word Smart, both illustration and special effect for eye, illustration for math, both for body, illustration for music, both for nature, and an illustration for self. So David's going to get us started with Word Smart.
Okay. We have an idea for you here for a choral reading, and this comes from
the Old Testament Lectionary, an Australian website.
Yes. And so we have the link for that, so you can go see it directly, or you can find it laid out in our worksheet at morethanhearing.org for this week. It's the Job reading combined with Psalm 104. And so you have two voices going back and forth. You have God demanding from Job, who do you think you are? And do you know how to do all of this? And then from the psalm, it's a creation psalm. Mm-hmm. And so it's saying, God did this.
Yeah.
God did this.
Yeah. And Psalm 104 is the psalm, one of the two psalms for the day.
Right. So it's a back and forth. So you can set it up either with a liturgist and the congregation responding, or you could have two readers, or you could split it down the middle of the congregation, or you could do, you know, whatever variations you want, or get some folks together to be a choral reading choir, as it were, and split it up that way.
Yeah, it could be really effective.
Yeah.
I wish it had been our idea, but it wasn't. So
no, but we are glad to bring it to you nevertheless.
Exactly. For iSmart, as an illustration of what's going on here in this particular passage, God is removing Job's close-up focus on his own situation to a wide-angle vision of the entirety of creation and showing Job that God's own creative spirit is holding everything together here, including his suffering. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of a self-smart in this. We have the visual image of zooming out to a wider scene, but the self-smart of this is one's own situation is part of a much larger fabric. This really doesn't lessen your suffering, but it certainly places in a different perspective and under the care of a far bigger God. Mm-hmm. So there's an illustration, eye illustration and self-illustration for that. For a special effect, sticking with this idea of zooming, bring in a camera with a zoom lens to demonstrate that idea, or display a high-resolution landscape photo, first zoomed into a very small detail and then zooming out to see a bigger picture. You could even probably, if you have internet capacities, just put up a Google map, maybe of your church. Right. And maybe start really big and then just zoom into your church. Go the opposite direction.
Yeah, nice. And then back out again.
And then back out again.
We kind of did this last week.
But yeah, we did. But you know, it's a good illustrations, and this seems to be really effective for this particular place. Also, for special effects, for iSmart, we frequently have artwork, and we've got three samples for artwork for an iSmart special effect. To connect with the devastation that Job has been experiencing, we have a link to a website called Backyards and Beyond. And in that particular website, there is a series of paintings from post-Katrina people in Mississippi, people who experienced a great deal of devastation from the flooding. So this particular artist has a lot of paintings of what that's like. So if you want to connect it to devastation, you can do that. There's also an awful lot of just photo imagery out there of devastation that you could find. It's depressingly abundant. Mm. Another option, there is a painting by William Blake called When Morning Stars Sang Together. And he has, I think this was in the 1800s, he painted a series of paintings about the book of Job. So you can go follow this particular link that we have for you and see all of them. And then finally, we found a link to a painting called simply Job by an artist named Francis Gruber, who painted this in 1944. And it's an interesting painting because in it, Job looks very emaciated and is nude. And the style of the work, the year of the work, it's, what did you say? It was painted during the occupation in Paris, right?
It was months after the
liberation of Paris. Okay. Possibly before anybody knew what was going on in the concentration camps, but the emaciated figure of Job in that picture made me think of that.
It's definitely evocative of the period, yes.
Yeah.
Going on to MathSmart, God's response to Job comes after Job has pursued a linear appeal for the disaster happening to him. And this comparison comes from an essay by Todd Weir at Blooming Cactus that he wrote in 2012. So we have a link for that article. And then we tend to think of life in terms of Newtonian physics. Right, that there's cause and effect, and that's generally how we experience things in the macro scale here, right? But life is often more like the subatomic theory of quantum mechanics or the theory of relativity. Impossible things happening, and two things that are diametrically opposed, both being true at the same time. Those are things that can happen in those other forms of physics. So making sense of suffering is often pursued as a Newtonian. I hurt, and what happened then to make me hurt? What's the mm-hmm. cause and effect relationship here? Mm-hmm. But sometimes the suffering is not quite so clearly cause and effect. Mm-hmm. And there's no clear origin or simple cure.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's even layered. Maybe there's one thing that starts it, and then you pursue a path to alleviate that, and then something else falls in. And so then the suffering just kind of becomes complicated and complex and compound.
Yeah. We put the physics part in math because...
Math. Science.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Moving on very quickly to body and music. For body, God tells Job, gird up your loins. And so we have a link to an article, The Art of Manliness, that shows you how to gird up your loins. Mm-hmm. And as a special effect, do it. Wear a skirt or wear a kilt or have a tunic and then demonstrate how it works.
Bifurcated garment.
Yes. Practice it before you do it in front of people because you don't want to flash anybody. And then for Music Smart, we have a poem called If I Were in Charge of the World by Judith Viorst. And it's kind of a sort of a child's understanding of being in charge of things. I like it. It's very good. You should go read it. And we also have a song, Paint with All the Colors of the Wind, from Pocahontas. Pocahontas is essentially saying to John Smith, yeah, you've got an idea of the world, but what about this one? Mm-hmm. And question to John Smith, can you paint with all the colors of the wind? Sort of sounds like God saying to Job, where were you when I did all of this stuff? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For Nature Smart, I read a book while I was on sabbatical called Stars Beneath Us. And I think we mentioned this last week too, maybe. But Stars Beneath Us, Finding God in the Evolving Cosmos by Paul Wallace. And he uses Job's story as a way of exploring how our theology is connected with our cosmology, and pointing out that our cosmology, our functional cosmology in the church and in the general population, mm-hmm. is really still based on the European Middle Ages concept of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Up and down.
Up and down. It's all up and down and perfect spheres in concentric circles, mm-hmm. and things like that, with Earth being the least holy place in the universe, and then expanding circles of holiness until you get to God out there, mm-hmm. Who is perfectly holy. It's also connected with Ptolemy's work as an astronomer. He was around 150 AD. And so, again, that idea of the perfect spheres. Mm-hmm. And it took us 1,700 years, 1,600 years before somebody got the idea that, you know, maybe it's not all about circles and spheres. But anyway, like Job, we have to reorient our understanding of God as being wider and more connected with the cosmos, mm-hmm. than we would imagine. And as God reveals in this discussion. Mm-hmm. So through these few chapters, I mean, we get 7 verses for the lecture.
Right,
But it's really 3 or 4 chapters where God just lays out, moving Job from his little tiny world out through the wilderness and then out into the really wild places and finally to the depths of chaos, mm-hmm. and that God is present in all of those places, mm-hmm. and rejoicing in all of it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different way of thinking about the world, and it's that expansion of the cosmos that really seems to give Job a sense of satisfaction.
Right. Well, yeah, allows him to find some sort of solution or resolution. Resolution,
yeah,
more than solution, but a resolution to what's going on with him.
Right.
Yeah. And I wonder if maybe comprehending that is what, because at the very end of Job, everything is restored to him.
Right.
So maybe it's comprehending that that opens the doorway into a new way of, into a new life, restored life.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because Wallace starts off by suggesting that this is a critique of the thought that if you live righteously, you will be rewarded.
Right.
Because that's Job's story. He
right.
lives righteously and he's been rewarded.
Right.
And here everything is taken away from him and he suffers. Mm-hmm. And so the message seems to be, yeah, that's not how things work. But then it gets it all restored.
Right.
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 Which is like, well, now what? But the thing is that there appears to be a little change, and this is actually next week, but there seems to be a little bit of change in Job.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a wider perspective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the key for that is that he makes sure that his daughters inherit.
Uh-huh.
And they're named.
Oh, wow. Well, hold on to that. We'll get to that next week.
So, yeah. Anyway, I recommend the book. It's a pretty easy read, but there's a lot to think about, and you won't probably be able to get it done by Sunday. But anyway, read it anyway. It's good. For a special effect, to connect people with that and to get them in touch with their cosmological theology, if you will, ask them to point to where different things are in the cosmos, right? So where are the stars?
People will point up.
Yeah. Where's the moon?
Up.
Where are trees?
Out there.
Over here. Where are the people?
Same place.
Right here around me, right? Where is God? Up. Mm-hmm. Most likely, right?
Mm-hmm.
The expectation is that mostly they're going to be pointing up. But the cosmological reality, of course, is the Earth is round.
And right.
And moving through a three-dimensional cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
So there are stars under our feet. And that's where the title from that book comes from. There are stars
beneath
us.
Mm-hmm.
And there are trees and people beneath us. And so where is God?
Beneath us.
And above us
and
around us.
And around us.
Right? So God is much more involved all the way around us than we are prone to think. So so we tend to work from a flat earth cosmology
mm-hmm.
when
totally.
We talk about our theology or our experience of the world because it's very localized.
Mm-hmm.
And so by breaking out of that, we expand our sense of God and God's invasiveness in the cosmos, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nature smart because of all the natural elements there. There's eye smart because of the spatial relationships.
And visualizing it.
And visualizing it. And there's some body smart in getting people to point.
Yep.
So there you go.
Okay, finally, for self-smart and illustration, we have a quote from Teresa of Avila, and we have a link to where we found it from. Scroll all the way to the bottom of it. But she said this, "Oh, my Lord, how true it is that whoever works for you is paid in troubles. And what a precious price to those who love you if we understand its value."
Hmm.
It's possible she was thinking of Job when she wrote that. Maybe it was her own life. Maybe it was the suffering of people around her that inspired that. But that's maybe something to set in front of yourself to contemplate, maybe for your own personal devotion, or maybe include it somehow in prayers of the people. Hmm. Also, God's response to Job could be understood to be dismissive or trivializing, and consequently, listeners may hear that God is indifferent to suffering. And we believe this is not the case at all. Even though God doesn't answer Job's complaints directly or succinctly, Job seems to be entirely satisfied that God has showed up and placed his sufferings in context. And we'll see that also in next week's reading too. So be mindful of the message you may unintentionally send in talking about God's response to Job in this passage.
Okay, let's go on. The gospel lesson for year B, ordinary 29, is Mark 10, verses 35 to 45. Here we have James and John coming to Jesus and asking him if they can sit at his right and left when he comes into his glory. And Jesus says, "You have no idea what you're talking about." "Can you drink the cup that I drink?" "Oh, you betcha." "Well, all right, you will, but I can't give you what you're asking for. Not my place." So then everybody's mad. The 10 get upset because of what James and John have done. And Jesus sits them all down again and says, "Look, you still don't get this, right? So it's like this. The Gentiles like to lord it over each other, especially when they're in charge, but not with you. The greatest among you will be the servant of all, just like the Son of Man who came not to be served, but to serve." So, setting up for the passion here. We have one, two, three, four, most of the stuff. Okay. We have some Word Smart illustrations, special effect in iSmart, and then illustrations for Math Smart, Body Smart, Nature Smart, People Smart gets both, and Self Smart illustration. So let's begin with Word Smart.
All right, that's me. Okay. We're looking at verse 38 and Jesus' use of metaphor here. It seems to be kind of indirect for the situation, especially knowing how dense the disciples have been about his mission and his passion. Verse 38, Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And
it would have been nice if he gave a little more detail on what he was talking about.
Right. What is he saying there? I mean, it would be sort of like saying Jesus might have said, "Can you have the ice cream with sprinkles that I'm having?" And by ice cream with sprinkles, I mean torturous, painful, humiliating death. It's like, okay. We understand what he's saying because we're on the other side of this. We know the ending of the story. And so it's like we're going back and we're watching an old episode or rewatching an episode of a show. And we get to that dramatic point. And it's like, yeah, we're in on this. But I don't know. Would we have that kind of insight that was necessary? Because I suspect that the baptism of Jesus in Mark's gospel was just entirely befuddling to the disciples. They don't come off well in Mark's gospel anyway. And Jesus not being particularly direct doesn't help any. So yeah. Anyways, that's a way of illustrating that particular verse. And then a question for words that we hear. What goes on in our modern heads when we hear Jesus say that to be great, we must be the slave of all? So when we hear that, do we warp the meaning of the word slave, or do we just decide, I'm not going to be great. I don't want to be a slave. Mm. There's also some self-smart intelligence in that, too, in considering our own response right. to the word slave. And then for iSmart, we have a special effect. James and John want to know who's going to be on Jesus' left or right hand. And so at the blog post, Art and Faith Matters, Lynn Miller posts a couple of different pictures in artwork. There's a painting and a mosaic that she posts. And who is represented in art as being in Jesus' left and right hand? Ordinarily, it's Elijah and Moses. So we go with the idea of the figures of the Transfiguration. And then in classical art, we get a variety of people post-resurrection who might be at Jesus' right and left hand. But if you read on into the gospel, who is it that's at Jesus' left and right hand? It's two criminals.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be an interesting image, way of looking at who gets that position of honor in Jesus' life. Maybe just walk your people through that picture by picture, and then come to the to the two criminals at the end.
It might be fun to make your own too. You know, find some public figures now who might want to be in those places, or a couple of the people in your congregation, maybe. You know, the pastor and the clerk of session, or
right.
Yeah. For MathSmart, looking at verse 45, where Jesus says that the Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many, that got me to thinking theologically. And so we have a link to an article by Stephen Morrison that summarizes seven different theories of the atonement, including the ransom theory, that Jesus gave his life as a ransom to get us free. There are some theological problems that people have with that idea, like who does the ransom get paid to? And historically, from Origen, I think it was, and a few other the early church fathers, it was paid to Satan. But some folks have a moral problem with God paying off Satan.
Yeah.
So then it sort of gets turned around. Well, it's paid to God. Well, but God isn't holding anybody captive. So,
makes God the Godfather.
Right. So then it's maybe death and sin, but that gets pretty metaphorical. So anyway, you can explore that in more detail in that article. It's in math because of the logical parts of theology there, but it also has a lot of people smart in it. Then going on, we have a quote from David Loess at his blog In the Meantime, where he writes, "But what if Jesus is saving us from ourselves? What if Jesus is ransoming us from the future we think we want, from the baptism and cup James and John believe they need, from the glory that they and we misunderstand, from the life that we've been urged to strive after, but ultimately is not abundant life, from viewing companions and competitors and fellow children of God as threats?"
I kind of like that theory. It's not so much, you know, Jesus had to die to save me as much as Jesus died to show me how much I need saving from me.
Yeah. That's on the list that Stephen Morrison has, actually.
Cool. So maybe David Loess read that article.
It could be.
Okay. Going on to body smart, we're going back to verse 38 and drinking the cup that Jesus will drink. I was reading along through something, I don't know, I don't even remember where it was now, but somebody suggested that they had once heard that Roman soldiers, before going into battle, would drink a cup of wine. As a way of fortifying themselves, or as everybody drink from the cup so that we're all in this together, sort of a solidarity thing. But it's an interesting image that if that is something that was well known in the culture at the time, then maybe Jesus was, you know, kind of borrowing that image that I'm heading into something that's going to be like a battle, and I'm very likely going to die at the end of it, so I'm going to drink this cup before I go. It's an interesting way of looking at the cup of salvation.
Yeah.
In communion. Anyway, so we put it in body smart because of the idea of drinking.
For nature smart, consider the struggles in animal packs for alpha dominance, or setting up the hierarchy. You know,
A pecking order.
Wolves, bighorn sheep, monkeys, apes, chickens, pecking order, right? All of these and more have internal power struggles and physical confrontations to determine who's at the top of the ladder for social and generally reproductive privileges. So are we much different
We
are mammals too. So can we, with our big old brains, overcome those natural inclinations, which seems to be what Jesus is encouraging us to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a few links for you to some articles on the topic. So we have a link to some summaries of scientific papers on the linear and nonlinear hierarchical dominance in different sorts of animal troops. Linear being wherever you are in the list, you're dominant over everybody below you, but not above you. Mm-hmm. And in nonlinear, it's more complicated. It might
be like
a over B, B over C, C over A.
Oh.
You know, so it's overlapping. Then we have another link to some more scientific studies on similar topics. And then another link from Slate that talks about social justice in animal hierarchical groups. And so how that tendency kind of works against the linear hierarchy.
For people smart, we're going back a little bit more to verse 37. It's with James and John making the request. They're kind of like kids asking parents, which one of us is your favorite? It's me, right? And the wise parent knowing to not answer that question at all. My father always used to say I was his favorite number two daughter, which I am. So there. Yeah. And then verse 42, Jesus' response to the 12 about the Gentiles and their leaders who lord it over them, that's really on target, particularly for the Roman society at the time. And it's largely ignored when elections come around in our culture. I don't know that it's necessarily being ignored so much anymore.
Yeah.
But definitely the idea of the Gentiles, they lord it over them and they act as tyrants and make of that what you will. So special effect, verses 42-43. This might be a challenge. If you can find some, and you probably can if you're here in the United States right now, play several positive political ads, if you can find them.
They're out there.
Where a candidate makes a claim to be a servant of the people. Actually, yeah, I am thinking of two people.
Yeah.
I won't mention them.
No.
But yeah. And then play some negative ads, and those are the ones that obviously pop to mind first, showing the anti-candidate as an oppressor of the people.
I try and do this nonpartisanly, that
if
is,
you
know, show examples from both sides of both.
Or if you can't actually find examples, have people say, have you seen? And and maybe have them do this as an exercise in their own imaginations. But it's out there.
Yeah.
Okay, so then ask, what's the reality? What is your reality? And what sort of ads would someone make about you? Personally, I think if I were a Miss Big Shot, told you so, queen of the world, when it comes around to election season, the first candidate that goes negative automatically loses.
Yeah.
Make it so.
For SelfSmart, we're looking at some work by Suzanne Guthrie at the Edge of the Enclosure, which is her blog. And this week, The Alchemy of Suffering. It's an essay about the holiness of suffering, and especially when we recognize it in others and in God, and when we enter into the sufferings of others.
Mm-hmm. Recognizing that we have suffering in common.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that you're suffering one thing, I'm suffering another thing, but we look into each other's eyes and we see that each of us is suffering. And so that kind of unites us.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, that makes the suffering more bearable.
Yeah.
It's Romans 15.
Bear one another's burdens.
Absolutely.
Exactly, indeed. So take a look at that. It's not very long, and it's pretty good and meaty stuff. There's also a lot of other really good material.
It's where the quote from Teresa of Avila comes from for the Job passage.
Right. And there's a lot of other good stuff on that page about suffering and compassion, which would tie in well with the second half of this passage in particular. There's a story especially about Josephine Bakhita, who was a slave in Africa in the late 18s and into the 20th century that you want to take a look at. Anyway, look at all that stuff and well, I was going to say have fun with it, but it's about suffering and compassion. So it's,
be enlightened.
Yes, yes, and enlighten your folks.
Right, there you go.
That's it for today's podcast. Please ask questions or leave us a comment on our website, www.morethanhearing.org, or facebook.com/morethanhearing, or tweet us at morethanhearing, or email us at connect@morethanhearing.org. If you tried any of these suggestions, or maybe even got an idea that you liked better than ours, please let us know what you did and how it went. We would love to hear how using this theory has made a difference in your preaching and worship.
Remember to check out the show notes, worksheets, links, and resources at our website. They go hand in glove with the podcast and give you lots more material to work with. Don't forget to subscribe using the links on the website for iTunes, Google Play, Android, or good old RSS, or just point your podcatching software at morethanhearing.org/feed/podcast. You can help others find us more easily by writing a review at the iTunes store, and of course you can share the show with your friends and colleagues. We'll be back with another episode next week, so in the meantime, stay subscribed
and be smart.
The number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
This is a Whippet Good production.